Sports in Palestine faces a lot of obstacles that disturb the true essence of what sport is about. Under Israeli occupation for more than half a century, the industry of sport suffers greatly, just as the Palestinians themselves suffer daily.
We participated in several championships, including the Batna International Championship in Algeria. We also participated in the Arabic Championship and took fifth place. However, Palestine was deprived from participating in many external championships due to the Israeli siege that has been imposed for the past decade. In those 10 years, time goes by, along with the age of players, which means the end of their sporting career.
The Israeli occupation does not like to see Palestinian sports that represent the Palestinians as a civilian nation to the world with the ability to compete with other teams. The Palestinian athletes do not have immunity at all. Palestinian sports in general is not immune, whether in times of war or without war. You may find the Israeli warplanes shelling a sports club or stadium, arresting a player, or preventing a team from participating abroad.
And now, the national anthem of Palestine.
Sports for Palestinians could perhaps play a role in international forums, but the Israeli occupation does not want any positive attention to shine on the occupied territory, and so it oppresses sports development as a strategy to keep the international community away from the occupation's repressive activities.
For your information, in some championships, Israel imposed on the host nation not to raise any country's flag so that Palestine's flag would not be raised. However, in the last championship held in Australia, Israel was not able to dictate its preferences. So Palestine's flag was raised and the Palestinian anthem was played when the Palestinian team marched out on the grounds. This is considered an achievement for us.
Having Palestine's flag raised in the Asian Championships for the first time was a huge achievement. However, raising our flag in Australia is our biggest achievement, especially as we know Australia voted against Palestine 2 weeks before at the UN Assembly. Our nation has the right to have a state and live in peace. We deserve to live. Today we are among 16 Asian countries. Although our country is under siege and the most basic necessities do not exist, our national team is here today, among the teams of great countries like Japan, Iran, Australia, Korea, and others. When hearing the national anthem here in this stadium with the players and technical team, in which I'm a member, with the rest of the Arab, Palestinian, and Asian audience, which supported our team to the finals, it gives you an indescribable feeling. This feeling comes because you're one of the soldiers who participated in raising the flag of your country in the international arena.
The Palestinian team qualified to the finals in the Asian Cup for the first time in history. The Asian Cup started in the 1960s. The Israeli occupation used to participate among other countries under the name of the State of Israel, as if Palestine did not exist. In 1970, a group of noble and honest Arabs expelled Israel from the Asian Football Confederation and replaced them with Palestine as a member. We regained our right to membership of the International Football Federation, in which we can participate in the World Cup. The occupation knows that sports creates a good image toward the Palestinian people, so it wants to sabotage it, destroy it, and hide it from the world. It wants to present the Palestinians to the world as terrorists.
For every athlete in Palestine, there is a sad tale of suppressed opportunity under the Israeli occupation, which deliberately puts obstacles before the Palestinian sporting industry to keep it behind closed doors.
One of the circumstances that helped me play football was living near Rafah Services Club and the UNRWA Club. I was able to get into the national junior team, the national youth team, then the Olympic team, and finally the national team. I received the best junior player title in the Palestinian League for the year 2005 to 2006. On July 22, 2009, I was supposed to travel to the West Bank
To join Balata Youth Center Club as a professional player at the boot camp of the national team in Al Farah. However, some other players and I were stopped and I was arrested. I was the only one among them to be arrested and without reason.
I was assigned to form the Palestinian Federation for Self-Defense Games, sponsored by the Paralympics Committee. This committee is specialized in training special needs athletes in order that they may participate in international championships and the Olympics. We received an invitation from the MRT Ahli Club to participate in the Dubai International Championship of 2016. We participated with a team of six players, one able female, an able male, and four visually impaired athletes. Our team competed strongly in this championship, and for the first time in Arab and Palestinian team, won third position and received a bronze medal. It feels great to raise the Palestinian flag and play the Palestine national anthem at such a championship. Upon our team's return back home, I was arrested by the Israeli police and detained for 5 hours, and the blind players were also held. My team insisted on not leaving without me. How could they leave when they have no one to guide them back home?
It's no coincidence that the arrest of Palestinian athletes has pushed a number of prisoners from the sports sector to more than 70. This number refers to the expansion of deliberate targeting of promising sports champions by the occupation.
I was detained without charge for no other reason than for being a Palestinian athlete representing my country. I spent 3 years in the Israeli prisons. During my sentence period, I was interrogated from time to time and manipulated to try to make me confess to anything. But in the end, they had to let me go. It shows to what extent the Israeli intelligence had nothing on me. They wanted to prove that they did not just arrest a Palestinian athlete, but a terrorist from their view. They could not prove anything, so they released me after 3 years. I was released, but with many health problems, because I had gone on a hunger strike for 96 days. These problems prevented me from continuing my football career. I do not wish for any athlete to experience the same situation I faced.
Upon our arrival to the Erez, Beit Hanun checkpoint, we were supposed to have a press conference with a number of international journals and agencies. But to our surprise, I was arrested and the blind boys were held and pushed outside. I was held for 26 days in the interrogation cells at Ashkelon prison. They accused me of training terrorists. I responded, "If you say that these blind boys are terrorists, I wonder how you can call them terrorists." It was bizarre. Bizarre that the interrogator was watching some reports on YouTube about the team, and he knew that I was training these blind boys. They presented me with a number of trials, 5 trials consecutively. Each trial extended my arrest period. I was released after the last trial, innocent of all charges. I believe that the whole thing was for the purpose of disruption and killing of our happiness, so that the people in Gaza would not feel the joy of our success.
The case of Hassan al-Rai is not the first one. We have more than 70 to 80 cases like his. There is the case of Sami Ad-Daur, who was arrested simply for being a national team player, along with Fadi al-Sharif. Ayman al-Nafadi received a medical transfer to have a crucial ligament operation. After his operation, he returned back to Gaza and was immediately arrested with his fresh injury. Beit Hanun Eretz checkpoint has become a daily arrest and interrogation point. Its purpose is to insult people. How could a country that presents itself as being a democratic state grant an entrance visa to someone and then arrest them?
Israeli violations were not limited to false arrests. They adhered to discriminatory policies of not issuing travel permits for players to participate in both domestic and international championships.
Athletics games are competitive. It requires capabilities. To become international, you need tremendous capabilities. It requires the potentials of countries, not individuals. Because of the siege on our country and the closure of the Rafah border crossing for the past 2 years now, Palestinian runner Inas was not able to travel to participate in a championship in the UAE. She was not given a pass to travel across Eretz Point. Furthermore, she was supposed to participate in the Beit Lehem 10-kilometer marathon, but she did not get a checkpoint pass for that either.
We exercised hard to have our names included in the Bethlehem Championship, but because of not receiving a checkpoint pass, I was deprived from participating. I trained intensely for the 10-kilometer race for 2 months prior to the race, even though I knew I had no permission to pass. We practiced hard, and I think maybe we could have won first place in that competition.
As a trainer for the national team, I suffered a lot moving between the governorates to reach Ramallah to be with the Palestine national team. It was hard for the players I chose from the clubs in Gaza to reach the northern governorates, which affected the competitive level of the national team. It is hugely suffering for the athletes inside Palestine.
We could not get the majority of our players to the northern governorates because of the delay in getting checkpoint passes. On one hand, because these games have specific dates, and on the other hand, the permissions to pass were either denied or given after the expiration of the specific date of the games. So Gazan athletes did not participate in these games.
Palestine participated in the 2010 World Cup playoffs. According to the draw, we were supposed to face the team of Malaysia. As we do not have a home ground, we used to play our games outside Palestine. We were matched up with Malaysia in an away game. We were supposed to meet the team in Malaysia, but 3 days before the match, the Israeli occupation prevented the Palestinian team from leaving. This injustice was not confined to the Israeli occupation. FIFA too was unjust towards us when it issued a statement in which the Palestinian team was condemned for not participating.
Practically every country in the world has a unified football league, with the exception of Palestine, which is forcibly deprived of that right. So the Palestinian Football Union seeks to at least unite the West Bank and Gaza Strip leagues to try to address Israeli measures that impose separation between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
The occupation is what divides the Palestinian territories into smaller parts. I'm referring to the 1948 Palestinian territories. There are the northern governorates of the West Bank and the southern governorates of the Gaza Strip. We try as much as possible to unite these communities by holding local competitions with the Palestinian clubs in the governorates of our land.
We have a diaspora league, the West Bank League, and the Gaza League. The teams in Gaza are not permitted to meet the teams of the West Bank, nor the diaspora. I mean, Barcelona and Real Madrid can move throughout Spain, but in Gaza, its teams play only each other, and the teams within the West Bank play each other. So there is one champion in Gaza and one champion in the West Bank. We've been appealing to the world to pressure the occupation to allow our teams access across checkpoints. This appeal is 20 years old now. We've had 20 years of league championships in Gaza, which have all been kept separate from the West Bank championships.
When the Palestinian National Authority took over, there were many attempts to have one unified league between the West Bank and Gaza. However, the obstacle of not having to pass the district prevented players from coming together. This also resulted in poor communications between the athletes and teams from each area. So we had to come up with the compromise of having two leagues. One league includes the clubs of Gaza, the other includes the clubs of the West Bank. I hope one day the winners of the two districts can play each other.
For a quarter of a century, we've appealed. And I myself appealed to football officials associated with FIFA, which is to have one unified Palestinian league. We want a league similar to that of the USA, Russia, Britain, Spain, France, Germany, and all countries around the world. We want to establish a unified league that unites the West Bank and Gaza, but Israel stands against this.
Setting a precedent, the Palestinian Football Union in 2015 held a match between trophy champions of the West Bank and Gaza, despite all that was done by the occupation to prevent any such meeting.
In 2015, the winners of the Cup of Gaza, for the first time in 15 years, met up with the winners of the West Bank Cup. They met despite the will of the occupation because of the intervention of FIFA. The away game was held in Gaza, while the home game was held in the West Bank, and then we pronounced the outright winner.
The union decided to hold a match between the champions of the northern governorates and southern governorates so as to decide a unified champion that would represent Palestine in the Asian Games. The match was between the Shujaya Union Club, representing Gaza governorates, and Al-Khalil Ahli Club, representing the West Bank. The Al-Khalil Ahli Club won the championship.
We were excited, but Israel obstructed the event by arresting a number of players, and the Shabak Israeli Security Agency interrogated them for several hours. In addition to this, many players were refused a checkpoint pass. If it was not for the interference of FIFA and other countries, this sporting event would have not been held.
The escalation of violations by the occupying forces against Palestinian sports and athletes did not stop at international norms. Its momentum increased in the wars waged by the occupation on Gaza, the most violent of which occurred in the summer of 2014.
Palestine Stadium was shelled with a dozen bombs, each weighing about a ton. The stadium was completely destroyed. Not only the stands, but the whole field was unplayable. The Rafah Municipal Stadium was also shelled in 2008. This city has champion teams, but we've been unable to rebuild the stadium until now. Till now, I find it difficult as an athlete, a Palestinian, or even a follower of sports and current affairs to understand why the occupation would bombard playgrounds and sports clubs. We don't know the reason except to think that the occupation does not want to see any young Palestinian, especially athletes, to achieve greatness in sport or for them to play other Arab teams or internationally.
Rafah Stadium was one of the targets of Israel's military complex. We don't know why. It is just a stadium like any other around the world. Palestinian youth play in this stadium. It was, however, shelled with more than just one bomb by an F-16 warplane. The building and the grounds were completely destroyed. Now it is a playground without any stands. Of course, the field is not suitable to play on, but it is the only one that exists. Fragments of steel and rock can be still seen there. Many players stayed away from the stadium because of the bombardment.
Clubs were bombed, centers were bombed. More than 30 sports locations were bombed during the aggression on Gaza. There are no more than 5 stadiums, so the agenda of the General Federation of Football was affected dramatically. The capacity of other stadiums is limited, so by shelling these stadiums, from the Israeli perspective, it totally disrupts Palestinian sports.
The recent war on Gaza by the occupation's military exceeded every human standard and killed more than 27 Palestinian athletes. They joined the long list of victims who were athletes and martyred.
In the past 20 years, 400 or so Palestinian athletes have been martyred. These athletes are from all kinds of sporting backgrounds, football, volleyball, handball, and individual sports like martial arts. All of these sports lost memorable players. More than 400 Palestinian martyrs sacrificed their lives for the cause of Palestine. The Palestinian athlete is a Palestinian citizen before he or she is an athlete.
Israel deliberately targeted the sports sector as it did other sectors, such as health, social and economics. We in the sports sector have 400 martyrs. At the top is Captain Ahad Zakout, who is one of our trainers. Many young players also were assassinated in the southern governorates. We as sports people are supposed to have immunity under international law to travel and participate, but Israel flouts these laws and international regulations.
On the morning of July 30, 2014, one Israeli war jet targeted a residential apartment with a rocket. The apartment was owned by the late athlete Ahed Zakout in the Al Nasser neighborhood in Gaza City, bringing an end to the life of an athlete who continues to inspire many even after his death.
I woke up to the voice of my mother screaming my name and my father's name, Khaled and Ahad. I went out and answered, "Here I am." She asked me where my father was. I say, "I don't know. I will look for him." She ran out of the house screaming for someone to help. The living room was on fire. A missile had hit the house, smashing walls and room and setting the living room on fire. My uncle was the first to enter our house.
I turned around and came into the house. The bedroom door was broken, blocking the entrance. I kicked it with my leg and was surprised to see Ahed lying under the separating wall between the bedroom and the living room. He was still breathing. His son then entered and started screaming.
We told him to bear witness that there is no God, but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. In his last moments, he was opening his mouth and closing it. Then the ambulance came and took him to the hospital, but he was later taken to the cemetery.
Captain Ahed Zakout was the star player of the Palestinian National Football League. He was the star of Gaza Sports Club and played in many clubs inside Palestine. Then he became a trainer after retiring as a football player. He focused on the youth. Captain Ahed Zak wanted Palestine to have a promising future. He focused on having a national Palestinian team that would qualify for the finals of the World Cup in 10 years' time. But it seems this dream did not appeal to Israel. The Israeli occupation focuses on how to hit us at the core.
Despite all the crimes committed by the occupation against Palestinian sports and athletes, they would not be able to achieve their aims to undermine the resolve of the aspiring athletes who hope to represent Palestine at international tournaments and to hold high the Palestinian flag in states that have ignored and still ignore Palestinian rights.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
سرات آخرت همونجوری که در روایت داره بعضیا مثل برق عبور میکنن یه لحظه.
As we have in our narrations, some people pass the Sirat bridge or path of the other world easily and fast. These are the people who were not attached to this world or did not commit any sins. Yet some will pass the Sirat bridge like horse riders. They are fast, but not like the first group. The third group is those who run and pass the Sirat bridge. Still, there are some people who walk slowly. There is another group of people who fall and stand up when passing. And the last group are those who fall down the bridge. The difference between the people passing the Sirat bridge depends on the path they selected in this world. The more sinful they are, the more difficult it would be to pass the Sirat bridge easily and fast. However, if they are pure and clean from sins in this world, they will have an easy pass on the Sirat bridge. Therefore, it is very important to select a way which makes our path in the other world easier and without hardship. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech on iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page, which was the English translation of a short Persian speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former President Donald Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence held competing campaign events in Arizona on Friday, 22nd of July, as both publicly back rival Republican candidates for governor. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Derek Roche. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled "Trump and Pence Stump for Rival Arizona Candidates." Former President Donald Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence held competing campaign events in Arizona on Friday, 22nd of July, as both publicly back rival Republican candidates for governor of Arizona. Thousands came to see Donald Trump at his rally in support of gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake at Findlay Toyota Center in the state's Prescott Valley, where the former president took aim at President Joe Biden. Mike Pence's visit to Arizona appeared to be more modest, as a crowd of around 300 people reportedly attended an event in Peoria at a store that manufactures tactical equipment. The former Vice President Mike Pence spoke in support of the gubernatorial candidate Karen Taylor Robson. Both Republicans are considered likely to run for the GOP presidential nomination in 2024. While Donald Trump has strongly criticized Mike Pence for his refusal to support efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The former vice president also visited the National Border Patrol Council's office in Tucson, Arizona on Friday. The Border Patrol Union has strongly supported Donald Trump, but has endorsed Robson in the governor's race. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey joined Mike Pence and Robson at the events, and the former vice president criticized Carrie Lake for previously supporting Democratic candidates. "When you get out and vote for Karen Taylor Robson, you can send a deafening message that will be heard all across America that the Republican Party is the party of the future," Mike Pence said. He added, "Arizona Republicans don't need a governor that supported Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton." However, Mike Pence did not mention his break with former President Donald Trump or recent revelations from the House of Representatives Select Committee investigating the events of 6th of January 2021. Speaking at his Save America rally in Prescott Valley, Donald Trump criticized Doug Ducey, as well as Joe Biden's handling of issues including inflation, and offered his full support for Lake's gubernatorial bid. Trump said Doug Ducey is all talk and no action, and you'll see what can happen when Carrie Lake becomes your governor. It'll be like day and night. He did not mention his former vice president in his remarks, but criticized Arizona State House Speaker Rusty Bowers, a Republican who testified before the House Select Committee about Donald Trump's attempts to pressure him into saying the 2020 presidential election was fraudulent. Donald Trump called Rusty Bowers a rhino, a coward who participated against the Republican Party, and endorsed his Republican opponent in the GOP state Senate primary. The former president also warned that the United States could be heading for a recession, somewhat similar to the Great Depression that began in 1929. "We've got to get this act in order. We have to get this country going, or we're going to have a serious problem," Trump added. recent opinion poll suggests that Carrie Lake is the front runner in the race in Arizona. The current Real Clear Politics average of recent Arizona surveys shows that the Trump-backed candidate leading her Mike Pence-backed rival by about 8.5 percentage points. A survey carried out by OH Predictive Insights from 30th of June to 2nd of July showed Carrie Lake with a lead of 5 percentage points. The Trump-backed Republican had the support of 40% of likely GOP voters, compared to 35% who supported Karen Taylor Robson. An additional 21% were unsure, while the rest planned to back other GOP candidates who garnered single-digit support. The opinion poll included 515 likely voters and had a margin of error of plus or minus 4.3 percentage points. Trafalgar Group conducted an opinion poll from 14th to 16th of June that had Carrie Lake in the lead by double digits. The former television journalist was backed by 39% of likely Republican voters, and Karen Taylor Robson was supported by just 27%. More than 17% of respondents were undecided, and the rest supported other GOP contenders. The survey included 1,068 likely voters with a margin of error of plus or minus 2.9%. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, who has faced substantial criticism from Donald Trump, slammed Carrie Lake in a recent interview on CNN. According to Doug Ducey, who cannot seek re-election due to term limits in his state, Lake's entire campaign is an act. He said the GOP candidate has been putting on a show for some time now and will see if the voters of Arizona will buy it. Conversely, he described Karen Taylor Robson as the real conservative. She's the real deal. She started her career working for Ronald Reagan. She's pro-gun and pro-life.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are going to talk about the family-related issues according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Mm-hmm. little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Sheikh Javid, we are talking about family-related issues according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And at the beginning of this episode, let me ask you this question. Is it permissible for women to clap in happy occasions like wedding and birthday parties? Assuming that it is permissible for the women to clap in such events, what if the sound of their clapping, goes out of their venues and it goes beyond and is heard by non-mahrams?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There is no problem in clapping in the manner which is generally accepted by common view. Mm-hmm. You know, women can clap their hands and, you know, express their joy or their appreciation. It is permissible per se, even if the sound actually is heard by non-mahram men, provided that it does not lead to any bad effects or bad consequences, negative mm-hmm. consequences. Yes. We cannot say it in a general, in a straightforward manner, and no religious authority has ever said that it is absolutely permissible. You know, if it does not lead to any vile consequences, mm-hmm. it is permissible per se.
I see. How about clapping in religious ceremonies? For example, normally accompanies these ceremonies, normally entails songs of praise for the Prophet and his household, you know. And the recitation of salawat in birthday parties of the infallibles, for example, and other religious festivals. And would such a ruling or be different if these celebrations are held in places of worship, religious centers, such as masjids and prayer rooms in government departments and institutions?
Generally speaking, there's no problem in clapping in the way which is common in such celebrations. It is permissible per se, and it is a kind of, it's considered to be a gesture of encouragement, or it's a form of approval of the activity that is going on, for example. And Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, has said that it is more meritorious, it is more virtuous to adorn these celebrations or these celebratory atmosphere with the sound of chanting salawat in the on the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and of course by reciting Allahu Akbar and these are especially recommended when such events take place, and especially in masjids and similar places. Of course, masjid has to be separated from other places because it cannot be compared with, let's say, government departments or institutions. Masjid is a holy place dedicated for prayer, for glorification, for praising Allah. So clapping,
And the difference is that special formula which is pronounced for it to be a masjid, right?
Yeah, of course. So it is if people want to clap their hands as a gesture of encouragement, they can do so in Husainiyas, mm-hmm. Okay? Because Husainiyas are, or they call it Imambarga in the Indian subcontinent. And this is Imambargas or Masaj or Husainiyas are dedicated for celebrations and these things. So the masjid has to be, used for worshipping, for praying, for reciting the Holy Quran. Mm. And of course, just as I said, it is more meritorious and more virtuous to recite salawat as a gesture of encouragement, and to recite Allahu Akbar,
yes,
to chant Allahu Akbar.
Okay,
and it will be more meritorious.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, is still in the studio answering very nicely the questions that I raise about family issues according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Javid, what is the criterion for what we know as the fame clothes, better known as or otherwise known as Labas-e-Shohra?
Yes. They are the types of clothes that are not suitable for wearing because of their color, because of their design, and because of maybe that the stitches, because they attract the attention, these could be some of the reasons which make a clothing forbidden to wear. Like the color is very flashy, it is eye catching. And if a woman wears that dress, she will definitely attract attention and people will follow or chase her.
Mm-hmm.
So the yardstick or the criterion is that when the person wears such clothes, they would definitely attract the attention,
mm-hmm.
or the attention of other people. And they attract the attention so much that their look would be kind of, haram look. They will continue looking at. Okay, sometimes you may see a woman
mm-hmm.
With normal dress, that the dress is not attractive.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, new, it could be beautiful, but, it has to be left and relegated to the society, to the common view.
Right.
Some dresses are really flashy. They are eye-catching. And it's not permissible for a man or a woman to wear such dresses.
Mm-hmm. I see. So quite related to that issue that you said, is it permissible for women, especially young women, to wear clothes that are in screaming colors, such as dark blue?
There's no objection to a woman wearing such such dresses in and mm-hmm. of itself, unless it attracts the attention
mm-hmm.
of other people and leads to bad consequences. Dark color is good. So, the color, Islam is not opposed to the color,
Mm-hmm.
What makes a dress forbidden to wear is the design and maybe that special color that's mm-hmm. used, which is not common. And like, for example, red is very flashy. It attracts the attention. In Iran, for example, if a woman wears a dress in red and she comes out into the street, she will definitely attract attention. But in the Indian subcontinent, mm-hmm. if a woman wears red, it's a kind of normal dress,
mm-hmm.
and she will not attract attention. So it depends. It differs.
Depends on the culture.
Yeah, on the culture and from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
The situation and the ruling may differ.
I see.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. For me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun man jamilaha illahum ghaffarun jamilun wahhabun latifun تَوَّابٌ سَمِيعٌ بَصِيرٌ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا هُوَ وَحِيدٌ قَدِيرٌ مُحْيٍ مُمِيتٌ الظَّاهِرُ وَالْبَاطِنُ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا هُوَ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا هُوَ
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.